Clicker. Hi, welcome. People keep moving up front. We're not going to bite. So basically, what I'm going to talk about is kind of like from my perspective of what we do as independents. We all do kind of similar projects, so I'm going to relate some of the work that I have done and how I got into some of this. If you saw that chart that was the entry where you saw the green flag, that's a go. And so basically that's how I kind of started 9 years ago. I didn't know what to do, and basically I kind of called colleagues to see, well, how did you get started and what are things that you needed to do? So I've kind of taken some of that. I did not put myself into a business plan or create a business plan. I just kind of winged it. And so basically I put together a website, I put together a brochure, made cards, and then kind of just sold myself. And that's kind of something that's kind of different than when you're in an office, because here you really have to sell yourself and make yourself available. And so I'll just go through some of these things in terms of what the needs are of the client and some of the outcomes from the client. And so here's collection management. And so that was one of the projects that I'm working on with a client. And so in this situations that I've been in, a lot of the things are non-traditional art or objects or things that I've been working with. Here you can see I worked with a collector who collects baseball memorabilia. And so here I was called in by an exhibit designer who was working on this gentleman's collection in his house. So this is a very wealthy person who has this passion, and he decided to build museum quality galleries in his house. And so I went and so I worked with the designer, and he had museum fabricators and museum case makers. And so I've ended up being the kind of like the collection manager on call, being that everybody else who's installed this is out of the state of California. So I have to go in and redress mannequins or take down some of those baseball cards and things like that. So it's, you know, so I'm using all my resources from what I've done in working in the museum field. Now, I also, in this collection management, didn't even know what a collection manager was or is, and he still doesn't. He thinks I'm his curator, which I'm not. But he trusts me. I go in, I go out, and when I'm on call. I also drafted him a collections policy. He looked at it. I have not heard back. I've done collection policies for some other people, for some other museums, for the museum that I work with in Bangkok. We've been working on a collection policy there. So that might be a task that you're asked to do. Then we do condition reports. So this was a condition report I did on this Vassarelli, super large, and basically it was for a private client. He was in Las Vegas, but this work was in a gallery in Los Angeles, and it was being sent. So basically I got a call, said, could you do this? I said, sure. So you're going to get a call. You could get calls. I get calls from people on the East Coast, and I do work for them on the West Coast if the work is out there. So here you can see some other condition reports that I had to do. This was for the Museum of Musical Instruments in Phoenix. I got a call. The works were coming in from overseas. They had to be opened at the airport. So I got called down to go down to the airport and watch customs open the crates, because the material has ivories and other kind of things on them. And then these are other paintings and other works from private collectors. Actually, that upstairs was a piece that the High Museum had called me, and I had to open up crates that had been stored for a year at an art warehouse. And basically, it was this artist who made models and art sculptures, and so they just needed to call me in. So it was like a 2-3 day job to go in, open the crates, and then send the condition reports to them. Then we do inventories. And so basically, it's a wide variety of collections. Some are private collectors. Most of them are people that I didn't know. There are a few that I do know, and I did it as a friend to help them with their house. Or others, it was just a call, and they needed the work. So you get a wide variety of requests. What they needed, either they just needed photos of them, they just needed a quick little database listing, maybe an Excel list, or a full kind of, like for one client, for the paintings, I provided her with a disc of everything from a small database that I had found off the shelf called Bento. And so basically I had sent that to her. So here's another inventory job that was kind of fun. And this was Star Trek memorabilia. Basically, I got called in to help with this job. These Star Trek pieces were taken off exhibition. They were sitting in a place in Long Beach. And the exhibition had been put together by one organization, but then it got sold to another organization. And so we had to go in and say, okay, we're going to send it off to point B, point A, wherever it was going to go. There were no lists. So everything had been wrapped. We had to go in, unwrap them, re-inventory them, and then rewrap them. So so that was kind of a fun project to see all these kind of movie props. That's basically what they were. And then training. Training, as you see, if you can see, you've probably seen two of my registrars running around here. But so the training, I've gone to Thailand and dealing with helping them to become good and better registrars. And so with imparting that information, you might get that as a task. People have been traveling the world, or they're traveling in the States to visit a variety of places. Then we have storage. As you can see, the top pieces were from when I was in Thailand, and these are some of the things that they had done. The bottom that you can see, I had a three-month job with the Masonic, the Masons, in San Francisco. Basically, they were redesigning a new storage. They wanted me to come in, help them design it. I also helped them with their database that they had just gotten past perfect. And so it was an interesting learning about the Mason order and having their aprons and trowels and things like that. So besides that, you get to learn a little bit while you're doing the work. So then you have, basically, what kind of things were you needed? As I said, collections policies, loan agreements. You might have to write up loan agreements for somebody. I did that for the museum in Thailand. Deeds of gifts and the receipts and the condition reports. I did all those kind of forms for them in Thailand. I also did a collection policy for, I think it was the Museum de la Raza in Los Angeles. So again, it's you get to do quite a few amazing things. Now, in terms of let me put the glasses on so I can see my notes. In terms of like insurance for professional liability, I did not have it until I started the job on that baseball collection. They said that I needed it. I said, fine. All of a sudden, I get a bill. And the bill is $2,000.
What?
Yeah.
It was $2,000.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my goodness. And I said, oh, okay. And they ended up paying it for the year. So I didn't have to pay for it. So it was interesting. I had met with the client. I had met with them. They vetted me. And so it was an interesting relationship with them. As soon as the year was over, I got the bill again, and because I wasn't working for them on that full-time basis. And I said, sorry, I'll get my own. So, and I did. But it's interesting, and this was something that I had mentioned to Suzanne early on. I was thinking of putting together a session called Working for the Wealthy. Because sometimes, you know, when you have these wealthy clients, they have certain expectations or they don't know what you're doing. So basically, you have to educate them in terms of collections care, And also, you can be, you might be a little more lenient because of the expectations in terms of depending upon what the items that you're working with. Of course, if you're working with fine art, you want to do the highest standard possible. And you also try and stress to them the highest standards as possible. And so that kind of leads you into kind of like compromising. So are you compromising yourself or are you make compromising between you and your client in terms of, well, this is what you expect, or this is what you need, and you kind of just negotiate back and forth in terms of how you present yourself and what they expect back from you. So and so that kind of also negotiates in terms of rate. You have your set rate, and so hopefully you're going to keep that rate, and basically they'll accept it. If not, maybe then you'll say sorry, or sometimes you can negotiate it. For one of my clients, I knew that they were going through some financial difficulties, and so basically they had brought me out to their space in Sedona, Arizona. They put me up. They fed me, and so basically I lowered my rates a little bit. So it was, in terms of other legal issues, anything like that, if there's taxes that's involved, Suzanne had mentioned to me previously about something called a use tax, which I was not aware of. And basically what the use tax is, it's a type of excise tax levied by U.S. By numerous state governments, is assessed upon tangible personal property purchased by a resident of the assessing state for use, storage, or consumption in that state, not for resale, regardless of where the purchase took place. Fortunately, I have not had to deal with any of that. Suzanne might talk a little bit about that if she's had to deal with it. And let's see. And anything else? Also in terms of if a client calls, actually I had a call just before coming here, somebody had mentioned that they wanted me to store some items. I'm going, okay. I said, I do not store items, but I recommended where they could store items. So what I will do is if I know that I'm not qualified to do a project that somebody is asking, I will refer them to somebody else. So I will, you know, share the wealth between contractors. So I think that's it.
Great. Thank you, Ted.
Thank you. Okay. Now, what do we do? Escape?
Yeah.
Escape? Okay.
Find the cursor.
I got that.
Closet.
I got that. Okay.
Start the next one.
Go to the next one. It should be.
You put over the icon. Now it should.
Hello.
Boy, we're challenged.
Yeah, aren't we?
You look like you're a dumb guy.
Yeah. Okay.
Double click. Okay.
That's the way this is.
Thank you.
You're welcome, everybody. I had an earlier comment with the engineer in here that I thought was quite good when they clapped over there. He thanked everybody for clapping, and so we competed with clapping over there, so it was very nice. My part of the talk is more restricted to just labor and hiring labor. I've been fortunate in my years in the business to work in both the institutional, commercial field, and private sector in my own business, but having to manage groups of people, and so thus hire them, organize them, train them, manage them on site, and then deal with them throughout the whole process. So this not only deals with art handlers and such, which is the main body, but also sometimes it's been in charge of dealing with the conservators on the staff or the inventory assistants that are on the staff, so on and so forth. So I'm looking at creating this pool of labor, and I played with this indie issue a little bit, probably a little bit too much with the pictures, but I thought it'd be fun with trying to go along with it, because very similar, as Suzanne just talked to me about it, talking about being the pit crew, and it really is a pit crew dealing with the amount of staff and doing all these different sections of the planning and preparation. Okay. So the pit crew, planning and preparation. The key factors, I kind of laid it out with assessment of the project labor, and similarly, the course or track may differ, being shape, size, so on and so forth. I mean, there's times when I've had, you know, had to manage like five people and a constant group of laborers coming in for a specific project, or on a large project, maybe up to 40 people bringing them in of different talents and different skills. So it's looking at that as, it doesn't matter what size of project, location, country, and regulations, but key factors still remain the same about, as I said here, the car to run in full potential of efficiency and to win the race, because you want to be successful. And I'll talk about time elements here too, but when you look at it, these Indy drivers and such, when they sit there and create their races, the pit crew is very specific to a job and task with a lot of time elements and specific duties and responsibilities. So I've broken it up in these sections. The size of project, of course, deals with the logistical scope of things, the duration of project, the time frame, working again like a pit crew of people and trying to get something done in a period of time is what we're looking at. Not quick period of time, even though sometimes it is a quick period of time. Skill base needed, labor skills and number of staff. Supervision needed. How is the project managed? Because that's very important to keep all this time element and skill and labor involved to the point. Budget, we all have to deal with budgets, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but there's this financial structure, and also there's the limitations of budgets you have to deal with. And the last one, the human resource choreography, interview, hiring, training, and of course OH&S issues with staff. So we start off the size of project logistical scope. This is the Indy track in Indianapolis, and this is what I wanted to keep playing with this theme, because it projects it into another picture, but it's still dealing with a lot of the same elements. So the size and scope of the project, it's the big picture that we're dealing with, the goals and outcomes, the project, or we term the mission. So you need to sit there and determine this and lay it out for what vision you're seeing is this big picture. Then you go in and start dealing with the business plan, because it's always a business plan. And from my side, with just dealing with staff, a lot of times my staff are not concerned with the business plan, but I as a manager have to deal with that, because I'm part of this business plan, managing this section of this business plan. So dealing with it and looking at the big picture again, the founding support to do this project. A lot of times I've been involved with big museum moves and such, and we're dealing with who's supporting this whole institutional move and who's building this situation. And that's quite exciting for me to see and hear about, because I'm one small piece of this, of the wheel, cog in the gear, but it's still interesting to hear the whole support, because it needs a founding support and really a structural thing to make it work. So the logistical structure basics, or the race plan. So, you know, we're creating all this situation and we're part of the race plan, the hiring. So management structure or organizational chart. I'm a real firm believer in dealing with organizational charts, because then I've got a picture of who I'm dealing with and how the reporting structure goes. And a lot of times when I'm training people, I sit there and I bring that in first just to say, okay, here's the picture of who's involved, how all this works, how does this system work? Because I want people to know where they stand in the game plan. Supporting the structure for labor and hiring and training, you need to sit there and look at dealing with supporting the staff and investing in them. We'll talk about that more in the budget. So implementing the scope. We've dealt with this picture, so on and so forth, the race begins. So if I could have got the music, you know, start your engine and hearing this, wonderful Indy cars rev their motors and stuff, and they start pulling out and all that sounds, I would have loved it, but I couldn't pull that down off the computer for some reason. But anyway, that ad lib will help you a little bit. So, duration of the project, time work framework. Again, for staffing, this is huge, especially in the fact that when it's a casual base or temporary staff that I'm putting together. I might be dealing with some full-time staffers, so on and so forth, but I'm still dealing with this time frame. So we're looking at duration. So the duration of the project time frame, start and finish targets. Also, you have to look at the incremental deadlines and such in there, because you need to impose those so you can see where you're at within the cycle and so on and so forth. Now, I usually be hit with you with management and dealing with budgets, but it's very good with your staffing because you're trying to keep track of where they're going to be and when you need them. Communication, staff structures, again, going back to organizational charts, getting them in there so they know where they stand, who they're reporting to, and creating a clear communication structure. Meetings and protocols. I'm a firm believer in having meetings, not every day for 15, 20 minutes. I'm talking about meetings like in the morning to inform people where you're going, what you're headed. And sometimes you need to actually pull meetings, pull them together and have them so you can explain to people what they're needed to do. But anyway, time schedule, agreed schedules, updating and management, communication focus tool. All this is, again, with time and schedule, is trying to keep these things balanced. And then there's tracking in the time framework, documentation and historical reference. But dealing with it within the documentation sense is you're tracking your staff, you're tracking your hours, of course, you're tracking your pay, this sort of stuff. But you're also tracking who's doing what at a different time. So then you can reference them back. So the historical document then is you're referencing back to the project they did, type of work they did, and you can reuse them in again in the future. 720. Okay, skill base needed. So, I'll go through this. These are non-art or non-indie pictures, but this is staff moving things. So you can see skill base, labor skills, and number of staff. What skills are required? You need to lay all this out so you know what you're getting into, so you can know what hiring, and then you can look at their background as you're hiring these people. You look at the number of years they've been in the profession or the experience they've had, and then you're also splitting it up between full-time and part-time. Part-time, you might end up hiring, and I've usually had to hire like an extra, like say 50% more part-time people just to make it a one section of full-time people, because some people are artists and they only want to work 3 days a week, some teach 2 days a week, so on and so forth, to trying to create that pool. But full-time and part-time. Previous knowledge, as I said before, you can train on-site and you have your specific training situations, but it's best to try to deal with them and have previous knowledge before they walk in. Management of specific skills. Now, what I'm talking about there is sometimes you need to have focused management. So one of my examples would be like for rigging. Not everybody knows how to rig, and not everybody should rig. So you should change that over and say not everybody should rig, but not everybody knows how to rig. Some people think they do, but you need to get specialized people in that for that specialized skill is my point. Number of staff based on per project skill, hiring skill needed. Determining what your needs are in order to build these pools. And again, building these pools are, like I said before, with the temporary people, part-time people, you might be using people that only work 3 days a week, 2 days a week, so on and so forth. So you got to build that pool up so you can work and structure, have that group. So again, it's a management and balance of staff. So supervision needed. How is the project managed? Supervision is really a big labor key, and it's very important no matter what you do. So you need to get the people involved. It's essential. They need to be attention to details and, of course, punctual and committed to the project, because your supervision needs to be the structure. They need to be team players, and they need to be the leaders to influence your other staff. They need to bring in the aptitude and levels up of the other staff that they're working for, so they need to mentor them, work on them, and create that solid working atmosphere. So that turns into professional development, so on and so forth, to make them have a better work environment and also make them feel a part of it. The other thing is supportive pay. Now, that could be a subject in itself. I'm dealing a lot with that right now, with changing some pay structure and stuff with my employment. But looking at supporting the pay, so you want to get them in and you want to keep them in. But you want to have pay grades so they can work in and work at their level and then work up to their levels. Training proficiency. Some people need to be trained more than others, and you need to pull people in that can train on the job. So when they're working with other people, they can sit there and help the other ones along and help mentor them along. So leaders by example, time to educate, support, and nurture. Now, this is a quote that I love, and I use it a lot, but it's, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up people to collect wood and don't assign them tasks and work. Rather, teach them how to teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea. So, your endless immensity of the sea is the big picture. So you're really getting them involved. You can always teach somebody how to build a boat, but to float it and the love of sailing on that ship is bigger than that. So the immensity. So, budget, financial structure, limitations. A lot of things can go wrong, just like this old picture I found, which I quite love, with a guy looking at the tire flying off in the distance. But the budget structure, a lot of times the budgets are created by the non-collection staff. So as you're dealing with them, you're dealing with the finance department, so on and so forth, so you really need to work with them. This is commercial and institutional. So you're dealing with trying to set up this structure of staff and determining people to support it. So supports of all structure, quality stacks, quality staff leverage and duration. So getting quality stuff that staff will be there for a long period of time, and building up and keeping them there. So going back to what we said with the actual pay scale, quality equipment. You never can lack in quality of equipment. You need to invest in it. So said before, and I was talking to different people all over the last few days in the PAG conference, you know, with training and supporting your staff, look at it as an investment for the future and maintaining your job. And when you're a good manager, you end up managing staff, and you'll keep them, and they'll help you better improve your workload because you're not always having to chase backwards. And one of my favorite comments to staff is, I don't like taking steps backwards. I don't mind having you ask the question a few times, but after you've asked me it 10 times, then I start to worry. So, you know, I don't want to go backwards, but I want you to come forward with me. So budget limitations, tracking budget is essential. Uncontrolled adjustments. If you've ever worked with traveling exhibitions, you can see this same picture that you're dealing with staff on projects as in a traveling exhibition, because there's all these components and you start putting these all together in that tight fit, and there's always going to be something that you're playing with, juggling and changing around. So the uncontrolled adjustments, changing focus, deadlines and changes, so on and so forth. Dealing with the staff overtime and additional hiring, you have to look at how you can keep control of that and always focus on it. So the last one here is dealing with this wonderful picture of a pit crew in action. So it's the choreography of this that excites me. And I've always talked about it as, you know, a choreography of managing and getting people to do the things and what you need in a timely manner, so on and so forth. But interview, hiring, and training are three essential keys. And if you want to drop me a line, I do this a lot with hiring and training and so on and so forth. I can help you out if you got questions, so drop me an email about that. But job descriptions, placement of ads, and interview process are extremely key in how we deal with getting good quality people. Again, key is the hiring, quality of hiring, so on and so forth. Full-time hiring of the supervisors is extremely important, as I said earlier. And then training. Also, I want to throw in OH&S training and safety training. A lot of times that gets a little lax. But the thing is, it's, again, it's like the investment attitude. If you go in with a good investment and you train people with proper safety standards, so on and so forth, then that's key to their health and benefit. And the last picture here, I just like these two old pictures because, you know, it's waving the checkered flag at the end. The race is over, so you want to end up being the winner like the one on the left, or pushing along, trying to catch up, and hopefully being done. So if you got any questions, just drop me an email or ask me at the Q&A part. Thank you.
Here I am again with this thing. Okay. And I didn't want to ask. Oh, is he? Okay. That's good. Okay. Great. Thank you. So, greasing the wheels of your business and maybe starting the business. I think that. That's a question that's asked of me a lot, so I wanted to bring this out. Freelancer. In 2013, the Freelancers Union estimated that 1 in 3 workers in the United States were self-employed, approximately 42 million people, with more than 4 million or 43% of those self-employed workers are members of the creative class, a strata of work specifically associated with freelance industries such as knowledge workers, technologists, professional writers, artists, entertainers, and media workers. And I think we fit in there somewhere, those of us who are independent registrars and collections managers. But how do you get started? I don't think this is a business for a newly minted grad. Jerry mentioned a business plan, and I think that in assessing if you're going to try to start becoming an independent worker, independent consultant, or independent registrar slash collections manager, you do have to assess your expectations. If you're going to make a living doing this, you have to have enough breadth in your experience to offer services to make it viable for you to make a living. So having the chops, and for those of you who may not be in this country, do you have what it takes to fearlessly drive that car? And in order to support yourself, I suggest it helps to have a substantial track record in some of these areas, or if not all of these areas. Collection management, do you have experience in acquisitions and the processes of acquiring a work and accessioning it into the collection? Do you have experience with deaccessions? Maybe you're not going to sell something yourself at auction, but do you have experience in finding homes for things that are going to be deaccessioned from your collection if you've worked in a museum before? And have you worked with auction houses and their contracts? Have you negotiated loans and really carefully read the loan contracts? Do you work with insurance policies? Do you know how to maintain your files and organize your paper files? Because I think they're still critical. With respect to storage, do you know how to organize storage? Do you know how to do it safely with archival methodology? Have you ever had any experience with storing photography in cold storage? Have you talked about it? Have you read about it? Have you experienced it? Condition reporting. We've heard quite a bit about condition reporting here. Do you know the descriptive language that should be used, or are you going to rely on drop-down menus? Do you use the manual system, or do you use a tablet? Are you going to keep up with the tablet technology, or are you going to use manual? I use manual because the tablet is just clunky for me. I'm going to try some of those new programs, though. Database management. Are you good at Windows? Sorry about this, but I'm not. I can do databases in Windows, but I can't do this. Mac has always been my preferred vehicle. But then there's the cloud. Do you trust the cloud? Have you got experience with the cloud? Have you read about the cloud? So, and then there's exhibition management, all the logistics, the planning, the coordination, the budgeting. The budgeting is the scary bit because you have to really project something that is full of unknowns. I learned early on that if you added a minor, small, modest 10% cushion to your budget that it really helps in the end. Policy development, collection management policy, have you written one? IPM policy, integrated pest management, have you researched that? Have you written it? Do you know where to go to identify bugs, what database to use? Those kinds of policies are useful when you're going independent. Contract review. This is really important because if you've got a private client and they lend a lot, you need to understand what those loan forms are all about and how what they really mean, and the fact that you don't need to be afraid to change them and to make demands on the borrower if it's a private client's work. So again, in contract review, insurance, know what the policy is that they're sending to you if you're lending something to a gallery or a museum. And do you know what a UCC filing is, the Universal Commercial Code filing, which states very clearly up front that both the borrower and you understand that this is your work, and if they go into receivership, you still get your work back, and it doesn't become one of their assets that are garnished when they go under. So then you have your national and international relationships. If you want to start your business, you want to have these relationships with other registrars across the country, with conservators. You want to have a pool of conservators you can draw upon because you're not a conservator necessarily. I mean, some of you may be. You want to know who your pool of art handlers is, your temp art handlers, people who you can rely on to do a specific skill, whether it's making a mount or whether it's hanging artwork in a grid or whether it's helping you to put things away in an archivally safe manner. You want to know who your packers are, the packers that you trust. You want to know who your truckers are and what kind of truck they have. They're going to charge you more for a box truck than they are for a Sprinter. But they might just charge you the same amount, and you can talk to them about those costs. Who are the shippers? Who are the customs agents? Who are the lawyers? So on the business end of things, are you going to incorporate? Are you going to become an LLC? Well, to do that, you could go through LegalZoom, which I did, which cost almost nothing, but then they wanted you to have a registered agent, which is apparently a side business of theirs, which they don't call the same thing, and you don't need a registered agent. You can be your own registered agent, and that's the person to whom legal notices are sent. So in order to do an LLC, you have to file with the state, you have to publish in two local newspapers what your intentions are, and eventually you get your federal tax ID number, which you can use for taxes if you're a single person or if you make a lot of money and your partner makes a lot of money and you want to keep the business separate, the taxes separate from your personal taxes. It's a good idea to have your own bank account with the name of your company on it and no address, nothing else, just the name of your company. I have a credit card just for my business where I charge things and where I pay my phone bill, the phone bill that is for my company. And then there are things to consider like personal care. Most independent people who are single are stuck with health insurance issues. Many people who are independent, especially art handlers, I find, they have no health insurance, and that really scares me because they're in the vulnerable position. I'm not going to have a hammer fall on my toe and break my toe or something worse. And then retirement. If you're an independent person and you're a younger person looking at starting your own business, are you thinking about retirement? Because you really should, because your Social Security amount that's coming out, you don't have a plan. Although your taxes that you do pay, Social Security does come out of that. But it's not evident because you don't have a statement, a weekly statement, a pay stub that shows what you're getting, doesn't show where your money is going. In other words, you're just paying your taxes. So those kinds of things are something you really want to consider if you decide you're going to go independent. The business end of things, in addition, bookkeeping. I find bookkeeping to be really awful. I'm lazy about it. But you have to think about your taxes. Are you going to do estimated tax payments? Are you going to wait till the end of the year and find out that you owe $19,000, which is like maybe a third of what you made all year if you're lucky to make that much? But you can also, you have to be also savvy about your home office. How many square feet does it take up in your home? When I first started my business 10 years ago, my office was in the dining room. The dining room was in the hallway, and the hallway was in the kitchen. And I still figured out how much space I used in our little 700-square-foot apartment in Brooklyn, how much space I used and prorated everything, all of our utilities. I prorated everything so that I could give it to the accountant. And I had a desk on the table, and I had a filing cabinet next to the table, so I prorated everything. I'm not sure it was entirely legal because we did eat at the table too, but but those are things to, because now I have my own home office, and it definitely, I mean, even the guy who mows the lawn, I prorate that. So the lawn service, the electricity, the heating, just about everything, even the cleaning of the gutters, because if the gutters aren't cleaned after the leaves come down, I've got a leak in my office, and that's no good. So I prorate that too. So when you're considering expenses of doing your business, Ted talked about liability insurance. That number shocked me, Ted.
It shocked me.
You got the wrong broker, I'll tell you. I pay $450 a year for liability insurance, and it was required by one of my jobs, but I raised the rate, so I said, you know, going to make me get liability insurance to the tune of $1 million? Fine, I'm raising my rate, no problem. So you bill it back. Some museums will cover you. If you're doing a job for a museum, they'll cover you under their policy, but you have to ask. Office equipment and furniture, that can be an expense if you have a home office. I rely on my scanner so much, I can't believe it. I think it's a really critical thing to have. Your printer, you need a printer, you need a color printer, you need a high volume black and white printer, desk, a comfortable chair, because you're going to spend a lot of time in your chair because you're working from your home office often. Filing cabinets, I'm always dumping stuff out of my filing cabinets and thinking, oh yeah, I got to keep this for 7 years. But then I also keep disks of information, and those disks are just stacking up, and I'm wondering if they're still viable or not. So materials and supplies. Do you buy a lot of materials and supplies for each job, for each client, or do you have a stock of them? I like to keep a stock of certain kinds of things, like nitrile gloves. I always have a stock of nitrile gloves. I bring them to the job, and if they've got them at the job, fine, I won't use mine. Some of my clients, I buy all that stuff for them. It stays where they are, and I've always got nitrile gloves there. I just received a shipment of, you know, huge rolls of Mylar for another client. It'll go from my place to his, and that raises a question about, I'll talk about that a little bit. So other materials and supplies, I list a few of them here, which you can see. The computer stuff, one thing I forgot to put on this was a hard drive backup. Each of my clients, I have a hard drive backup specifically for them, and then I have a 2 terabyte backup regularly for my computer, which has all of their information in it. Because I maintain the data for them, because they really don't want, they just want a report. Sometimes they want a report with an image, no problem. Sometimes they want an Excel spreadsheet, no problem, I can download that. But most of my clients, they don't want to deal with the database. You need a phone, obviously, and you need to pay your phone bill. And you should use a personal phone for your personal stuff and a business phone for your business stuff, because the feds really will crack down on you if you get audited about using your personal phone for your business, et cetera, et cetera. You definitely need a camera these days. So getting organized. Starting out, I think you want to keep your resume current and relevant. You want to be able to show people what your resume looks like, what kind of projects you're working on, and yet you still have to protect the identity of your clients. A graphic identity template is a really nice thing to have, like if your business card and your invoice have the same color ways and the same text, the same font, it's kind of nice to have that consistency. You can have that consistency in your contract too. You have certain clauses in the contract, and you should develop your own contract rather than wait for them to come to something, because it'll be a 36-page thing that you don't want to even look at and have no understanding of, and it's just a time waste for you because you're spending your time reading their contract. So I have one ready to give to them, which would include information about the parties, the scope of the job, the estimated timeline for the job, and very often if it's a larger job, for example, managing an exhibition, pulling one together and traveling it, you want to be able to estimate intelligently how much time you're going to spend, because they're not going to ask you for an hourly rate, they're going to ask you for a job rate. And Then you've got warranties in your contract, which say basically, this is a confidential arrangement, and just normal warranties. You're not going to change the terms of the contract unless it's in writing and agreed to by both parties. And then you've got your signatures. You might have some other things in there, but that's, you know, you want to develop your contract clauses intelligently and to cover yourself and your clients. You may or may not indicate anything about liability insurance. Email address. Make your email address something that's easily identifiable with yourself. You can have aliases. Some of you know that my email address has been for many, many years squiggle@panix.com. It's been that way for 20 years, and I chose Panix because I was panicked moving to New York, and Squiggle was, you know, part of the old way of doing things back in the early days of computerization and email. The email address is always the first letter of the person's first name and the first six letters of their last name, so I became Squiggle. My favorite one is spatter@slam, which was Susan Patterson at the St. Louis Art Museum. But you can have aliases using your emails. You can have one email that points to the other, and, you know, like sq@art&artifactservices is my alias. And if you want to type all that stuff out, it'll just go to Panix. SIG files, those are really meaningful. I have one for my phone. I have two or three for my laptop when I send an email, and I can choose which one I want to use for specific things. Like, one of my clients is, the registrar for such and such a collection. It doesn't say anything about Art and Artifact Services, nor does it have my website on it. And then the website. Are you going to do a homemade website, or are you going to pay somebody to do a website? I have a husband who did my first one and a daughter who did my second one. And they're pretty static. I don't try to blog, but they do show what I can do. And so does my business card, by the way. If you have glasses, you can read what I do. LinkedIn is another place where you may wish to. I wonder how many people here are on LinkedIn. How many people here have gotten jobs from LinkedIn? Not so many. 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe? Yeah. I find it useless. And I'm not very interested in it anyway. Twitter handle, I'm now tweeting. So if your Twitter handle is something that's recognizable, that's kind of nice too. Let's see, getting paid. How much to charge? Well, we talked a little bit about equity and pay and doing favors for friends. I don't do favors for friends. I can't afford to do favors for friends, you know. But I do maintain the when I started 10 years ago, I was charging X dollars, and for those clients that I still have from 10 years ago, that's most favored nation, and they still get their base. And, you know, I don't do so much for them anymore because we've really smoothed things out and things are going well, maybe an outgoing loan or something. But I still charge the same thing. And you can, maybe after 10 years, in January it's going to be 10 years, maybe I'll just say, by the way, I think it's been 10 years. So the question for you is hourly versus job versus day rate. My day rate is based on 8 hours at my hourly rate, and if I only work 7 hours, it's my day rate. If I work a half a day, it's my half day rate, which is based on 4 hours at my hourly rate. So then there's the job rate, and that's when you really, if you want to do a job, if you're going to organize an exhibition for a museum who has no staff available to do it, you probably want to figure out exactly what you think it's going to cost, and you're always going to undercut yourself because that's just the way it is. They're going to throw stuff at you. But if your contract is right, it'll say, and additional duties will be negotiated separately.
They'll ask, you know, I mean, they'll ask what you're expected.
Who will ask?
For the job rate, yes.
Definitely. Have I got 5 minutes, or am I over 5 minutes?
No, you're running over, but that's fine.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's 5:08, so I just wanted to let you know.
Okay. Travel time versus mileage. I don't charge travel time, but I charge mileage because I drive where I live now. And if I take a train into the city, I charge the train. And if it's a last minute thing, I'll charge the 2-hour travel time. Both ways, from where I lived in the city. But I also keep track of time spent on a daily basis, both on my phone and the calendar, and I've got it color-coded by client. And I also keep timesheets when I'm working on my desk, and I'll write down 5:04, and this is what I'm doing for this client, so that I always have a running list when I'm able to build the client, when I build the client. And so when you buy materials for the client, you have to decide whether you're going to bill back the cost at cost, or if you're going to put a percentage on top. And it depends, I think, upon how much money you're putting out for your client and how long it takes them to pay you. So I really like the idea of at cost. I don't add anything on unless it's $1,000 of materials, and then I want to be able to pay my bill. Manna from Heaven, how do I market myself? Well, stay connected. Come to ARC Socials, tweet. Participate in the field, post to the listservs, attend conferences, and tweet. Where do the jobs come from? Well, they come from colleagues at museums with whom you've got relationships. They might be coming in the form of somebody's having a baby and you can fill in for them for a month or 2 months or 3 months. Maybe they're understaffed and they have unexpected projects, or they need traveling exhibition assistance. Then jobs can also come from vendors who know you, art services companies, accountants, lawyers, insurance brokers, clients will refer you to other people that they know. And it doesn't need to be a dog-eat-dog world, as my husband's students have written in their papers. You can share the jobs and refer to colleagues that you trust. My very first job was given to me by somebody who was busy, and she said, well, why don't you call Suzanne? And I'd never done a freelance job before, and I wound up working for that person for 3 years, inventorying the estate of an artist and rehousing everything. So I just want to briefly talk a little bit about ARCs. Am I there? Did I? On contract. Is that on contract? I can't see. Back. Okay. On contract is now at arcsinfo.org, and ARCS is really pleased to announce that, much like the American Institute for Conservation, AIC site, Find a Conservator, or the American Society of Appraisers, ASA site, Find an Appraiser, now anyone can find a contract registrar or collection manager on the ARCS website, provided that person buys into it. Not the people who are looking for people, but the people who are looking for jobs or holding themselves out to do a job. So this is for ARCS members who hold themselves out to do contract jobs. The jobs range anywhere from a couple of condition reports to a cross-country or cross-ocean courier job, or to a long-term but temporary part-time job and everything in between. You can find it here on our website on contract, which is a new button up at the top. And here's how it works. Individual ARCS members will pay a nominal fee in addition to their annual membership, fully update their profile on the ARCS website, and add their resumes to their profile. If you decide you want to do this and you pay your nominal fee, you will not appear in the on-contract part of the website unless you put up your resume, because ARCS has no vehicle for vetting your capability, and we don't want to be responsible if a client finds somebody who isn't really fully qualified for the position they are putting themselves out to do. So that's why the resume should be put up, and also it's buyer beware on the side of the person who's looking for somebody. But still, those who participate in the program can be found by searching the search criteria on the site, which is basically name and city or country or state, and they can be then contacted directly by email from the site. So you don't have to put your own email out there or your telephone number unless you wish to, but they can also download your resume. So I think that's it for me, and thank you, Ted. Thank you very much, Brent. And if any of you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
Hi, I'm Andrea Gardner from the Toledo Museum. I'm just wondering how critical location is in your mind. So obviously I'm in Toledo. It sounds like you get most of your jobs in California. You're in New York. If you're in the middle of the Midwest, you guys travel a lot for jobs, or it's really mostly local? So
I travel. I go to Bangkok. So, as I said, I'm in
I live in Southern California. As I said, I spent 3 months up in San Francisco. So, you know, if the client is willing to put up with the accommodations, you know, and the travel, you know, I'll go anywhere.
Brent, didn't you just come back from China?
Oh, I did. I did teaching over China. Doesn't like the sound of my voice. Okay. I did work over at there we go. I do most of my private work like that would be like for training and teaching and such. And I traveled to Hong Kong to teach a couple of 2-day courses for the University of Hong Kong and one for M Plus Museum. But those were things, you know, it's like when I arranged them, I said, well, if you could, you know, in my budget, travel costs, so on and so forth. So yeah, it's you know, it's kind of like at will to travel. I mean, other times, the job I recently had with Artex in New York or in Washington was dealing with moving staff, project managing the National Museum of Health and Medicine, Walter Reed Booth, for 3 years. And I had to live in Washington while my wife was living in San Francisco. So, you know, you travel around, you make do, but, yeah.
But you're making a living.
But you're making a living, and you're expensing it in to those categories, like both of these just said, too. So.
And, I live in New York, but I live upstate, so I'm not at the advantage of going out and going to openings and meeting a lot of people, so I'm just sort of hoping that I'll get jobs. But I travel. My first job was to travel an exhibition opening it at the Honolulu Museum of Art at the Contemporary Museum. And then I traveled that show myself on behalf of the curator to 3 other venues in stateside. And I've also had the great misfortune of having to wait for 2 whole weeks in Venice for my crates to arrive because they were coming by sea to the Venice Architecture Biennale, and I had nothing to do in Venice. But I will say, my clients are largely in New York, not necessarily in the city, although some of them are. One of them lives half-time in Hong Kong and half-time in Brooklyn, and for that collection, I've not been to the Hong Kong side, and I don't know if I'll ever get to the Hong Kong side, but it's still managing the collection from afar, so I can do that from my desk.
Hi, I was wondering, do you have to often give bids? Someone wants to know, how much will you charge to do this, to do that, and so you have to prepare it all, give it, and then you don't hear anything? I mean,
sure.
How much bidding time, how much time do you spend doing bids?
Yeah, it happens.
Yeah.
How much time do I spend? It depends upon the job. If it's a job I'd really like to have, I'm really careful and I spend a lot of time, and sometimes I just don't get it. But some of those people have come back to me later and hired me for other things.
Do you ever factor in an aggravation fee?
She used to work in a museum, too.
Yeah, 25 years in museums.
Hi, I'm Anne-Marie Perky-Levine. I'm just getting started as an independent consultant, and I'm wondering how important you think it is to become an LLC, if that's imperative, or what your thoughts are on that.
I'm not.
Okay, Andrea's losing her voice, but she says it's a tax question, and I'd have to be careful to answer that because there are tax implications, and I didn't know that, but I just thought, oh, I'm supposed to be an LLC, so I did it. Can you answer?
I would just answer your question. I think it depends, excuse my voice.
You want to come here, Andrea? Yeah, to the mic.
Sorry to sound like Tom Waits, but I think, you know, whenever it comes to, like, starting your business, it depends on how you file your taxes, if you're married or not, if you file jointly, if you want. You know, there's a lot of different ways, so you have, it's really good if you have an accountant for what you're doing, whether it's, like, a business accountant or somebody that you trust. My husband is self-employed, And I file self-employed. We file jointly, but we don't, technically I'm not an LLC. So, and I've been a contract independent registrar for 8 years, and so far so good. But we pay quarterly taxes. You know, like everybody I think has to figure out what works well. But that said, I think, you know, if anybody says, oh, you need to do this when it comes to taxes, you need to do the research and find out what's best for you. So that's my choice.
It's really true. Yeah. When I started out, I thought I had to be an LLC, and I didn't know any better. And so I found out how to become one. And even during the tax years, some years I don't make very much money, and we file jointly, and some years I make a little bit more money and we file separately. And so then I file with my business entity, but I also pay myself, you know. I move money around when I have a certain amount of money, enough to, you know, make it reasonable to shift from my checking account for my business, and I pay myself. It's listed as owner's draw. It's my salary to our household. So, you know, that's fair, but I'm also an S hooker. I sell S hooks. I sell S hooks on the side. It's the day business or something. When I do that, I have to send in W-9s to many state museums who are buying, like, you know, $50 worth of S hooks for their hanging their pictures on their screens, and I have to file a W-9, and I always put in my federal ID number for my business, and yet I never put that money in my personal checking account. It always goes into the Art and Artifact Services checking account, which eventually I get paid from. So I'm pretty careful about that. Yeah. Anybody have any other questions? No? Okay. Well, thank you very much.